Welcome to the Cop Doc Podcast. This podcast explores police leadership issues and innovative ideas. The Cop Doc shares thoughts and ideas as he talks with leaders in policing, communities, academia, and other government agencies. And now, please join Dr. Steve Morreale and industry thought leaders as they share their insights and experience on the Cop Doc Podcast.
Hello, everybody. This is Steve Morreale from Boston, and you're listening to the Cop Doc Podcast. Today, we have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Karen Amendola, and she works for the Police Foundation, the National Police Foundation, to talk about research, what she's doing, what the Police Foundation is doing, and what the research is being used for. So, Karen, to get started, please introduce yourself to the audience and let us know about how you got involved in police research and now with the National Police Foundation.
Sure. Thanks so much, Steve. Again, my name is Karen Amendola, and I'm the Chief Behavioral Scientist with the National Police Foundation, formerly known as Police Foundation. We have been in existence since 1970, and I have worked at the foundation for now just around 25 years. My career has spanned the range of functions from technical assistance and training and assessments to now research, where I've been working for the last 15 years. The National Police Foundation's mission is to improve policing through science and innovation. And we do that through a number of unique initiatives and through various aspects of our mission, some of which include officer safety, health and wellness, reducing violence and reducing gun violence, and anything that deals with police role in community, working in aspects of community policing, community engagement, and a whole range of issues that meet at the intersection of police and community.
So would you say that what you are attempting to do is, and to coin a new phrase, is some action research, research that is potentially actionable, that bears down on the practice of policing, but can benefit police?
So this is an excellent question that you're raising, Steve. In policing, the research standard has been much like it is across many industries, which is research is done over many years, and it takes a long time to develop research questions, implement them, evaluate them, etc. However, we are working these days to bridge the time gap in getting that information to the field. So I think you raise a great question in that, yes, we have always been focused on addressing the questions that are of most importance to the police and police leaders, and then how to get those answered in a systematic way that is rigorous and can help us to answer the questions in a research and empirical fashion. However, we still continue to do traditional research that sometimes takes 2, 3, 4 years, but we complement that now with various forms of action research that are on shorter time frame. We complement that with shorter term research that is more actionable and that allows us to answer intermediate questions in a shorter time frame. And so we get the answers out to the field.
So as a foundation, as a researcher, a think tank, where are you as a group getting the ideas to identify the needs? Is it from you, the researchers who know everything? And I say that tongue in cheek. Or do you have a group of people who are saying these are the issues that we need answers to?
That is a great question. I would say it's a blend of things. I'd like to say it always comes from the field, and really it's rooted in everything that's happening in the field. So the questions can come from law enforcement leaders. They may come from outside think tank and other organizations that are addressing policy sensitive questions and community. Some of the questions come from community about the role of the police in their community, but also some of our scientists have expertise areas. So for me, I focus a lot on officer safety, health, and wellness. I also focus a bit on eyewitness identification and some other peripheral issues related to performance of police. So each of us often generate our own ideas, but those are not done in a vacuum. We're not sitting in an ivory tower kind of formulating these questions. We're looking at what's happening in the field, what other research shows, and where the burning questions are that are facing communities.
Well, we see a change in the attempt for people to ask for evidence-based evidence-based policing. And so where's the evidence? And as researchers ourselves, I think we're always trying to figure out, well, where's the evidence? What does the data show us? And so in terms of evidence-based, I think the nagging question for me is that the Police Foundation has a number of people who are in large police departments, and yet most police departments are small. How do we get police chiefs to recognize the value of research and to make decisions based on data?
That's a great question, Steve. I think as we have advanced in the field over the last decade or so, there has been a greater attention paid to smaller agencies because there are so many of them. Where the difficulty comes in is getting enough participants in research to be able to answer questions mathematically. So in other words, in one small department, there might only be 8 officers. And so that's not enough robustness to give us some answers to questions. So many scientists are now looking across multiple smaller agencies, combining the research designs that way. But by and large, we can also learn, or we can take some of the lessons that we've learned from larger agencies and really apply those in smaller agencies where the context is not as important as the issue that's being addressed. So for example, initiatives that deal with health, safety, and wellness exist whether you're in a small agency or a large agency, whereas issues about community trust, et cetera, may vary substantially from agency to agency. So there are things that we've learned in broader research with medium and large size agencies that will absolutely apply to the smaller agencies. The other question that you sort of alluded to but didn't ask directly was this issue of evidence. What is evidence? And you talk about evidence-based policing. As Larry Sherman coined the term through an Ideas in American Policing lecture at the Police Foundation about 15 years ago. And it's a really interesting question. I'm actually looking into that more these days because what counts as evidence varies substantially across a discipline. And the standards of evidence vary across organizations that develop these standards, right? Mm-hmm. So what, and many of the evidentiary standards are based on the type of research study it is. So if you do a randomized control experiment, that this is more of a gold standard. However, there are poorly run randomized control trials, and there are very well run qualitative studies. So we have to think more about the quality as opposed to just the design features of research, because this is where we can get additional information about some of these smaller agencies. They may not participate in large-scale randomized trials, but they may have qualitative research done in those agencies that provides a lot of information that can then feed the research questions going forward. So I think this issue of evidence is, it's a hard one to grapple with because evidence to one might not be evidence to another. It's not the same as court evidentiary standards, right? Those are quite a bit different. And so I think you've really raised some of the most important questions as we talk about what do we tell people about what research is showing us. And not surprisingly, many of the research studies out there that are very rigorous and look at evaluation designs or use evaluation designs to look at broad questions often don't result in very robust findings, things that are hugely different. But sometimes we find things that are somewhat promising. There's existing promising research in the areas of procedural justice and de-escalation, for example, right now. And just recently, a study done in Louisville showed some benefits to de-escalation training and tactics. But all of this, again, relates to your question about evidence and how do we apply this evidence and where do we get it from? And then can it be applied across the whole range of police agencies out there?
I think police have a tendency to look for best practices. And that does not necessarily mean that that's best practices. What are you doing next door? Let's adapt it and let's adopt it. And that's not necessarily the easiest way. But how do you synthesize what can be very dense material when we're writing for scholarly articles? And how do we synthesize that so that police chiefs and police lieutenants can understand it and gain some ideas to try to put in practice in their agency?
Another excellent question, Steve. So you're really speaking to the question of translation. How do we translate these highly mathematical terms and statistical techniques into really clear and actionable findings? And I think the answer to that comes in organizations like ours, where our primary goal is not publishing in peer-reviewed journals, as it will be for many academic scientists, but actually getting that academic science to the field in a way that makes sense and is meaningful. And so some ways that you can do that is you present it to various people from the field. We have a range of fellows that work with us. Some are police chiefs, some are mid-level managers. We also have policing fellows that are officer level or sergeant level. If we work with with them, we bounce the findings off of them, and then we ask them what we need to do to clarify that in a way that makes sense for police agencies, and also to contextualize it, because sometimes the academic science misses the contextual issues in policing. So I think that translation process is not that simple, but it's essential, because if the science is going to matter to the field, we have to be able to translate it. What's more is that there's not that many organizations that are out there translating it, and therefore we find that practices are often 10 or 15 years behind what the science actually says. I've learned this a little bit in the work I've done on eyewitness identification. Standards have changed over time, knowledge has changed, and it's continually and now rapidly changing in the area of eyewitness identification. For example, much of the former science suggested that if somebody's confident in making their identification, that that has no bearing on the accuracy. But we now have growing evidence that shows that highly confident witnesses tend to be far more accurate than less confident witnesses in making the identifications. So these are things that the organizations like the National Police Foundation and others that are connected with the field, like IACP and PERF and the National Sheriff's Association and the National Organization for Black Law Enforcement Executives, as well as IATLIST and CALEA and others, can help to convey to the field in a way that makes sense and that is not so complex that it gets lost in translation.
I like the idea of translation. Thank you for raising that. You've said a couple of times, I've spoken a couple of times about health, wellness, and safety, and that emanated in some small part from the pillars for the 21st century policing. But when you say health, wellness, and safety, what comes to mind? What are the elements of that? What are the things we look at? You know, the first thing I think of is mental health in policing. In other words, the police or public safety officers that find themselves in some pretty difficult situations and seeing some the worst of the worst and how they deal with that and cope with that, but also the mental health calls that they go on. So it's a combination of that. But again, what comes to mind when you say health, wellness, and safety?
So first of all, you mentioned that some of this comes from the pillars from the 21st Century Policing Task Force report. And actually, it has its origins earlier than that, much of it in work that is done by the Department of Justice through its Office of Community-Oriented Policing and the Bureau of Justice Assistance, who collaborated to develop a technical working group on officer safety, health, and wellness. So in this case, that's focused on officer safety, health, and wellness. It's not that community health, safety, and wellness is not of primary importance as well, but that is their emphasis. Some of that fed into what was defined and outlined in recommendations in that 21st century report. But to get to your direct question about health, safety, and wellness, I think that the terms are often used interchangeably and they represent different things. And so wellness has been defined in many different ways, but the way that what comes to my mind when I think of health, safety, and wellness is that there's really two pillars. One is health, and that is broken down into both psychological well-being and mental well-being, as well as physical well-being. And those aren't really separate because, as we know, things like stress and fatigue have a significant bearing on emotional well-being as well as physical well-being. And so things like sleep disorders are more prevalent in police than they are in members of the general population. And so what does that say about shift practices, et cetera, and how can you counteract those effects? But all of those things can have, if you have a sleep disorder, that can interfere with your long-term health as well. Things like heart problems and breathing disorders and things like that. So you can't separate out the two, but they're really two separate arms of it. In terms of work that we're doing, and we're doing a lot in this area right now, but recently we were awarded, in fact, starting this month, an award from the National Institute of Justice to examine organizational stressors as they impact officers' health and mental wellness, physical and mental wellness, and in addition, their performance on the job, as well as any kinds of mitigators or things like resilience that can help to counteract those effects. So we're examining that because the term organizational stress is differentiated from the term operational stress, which deals more with the day-to-day. So the organizational stressors deal with the day-to-day bureaucratic things and the nature of the work, for example, that you're working shifts, that the management of the organization, a whole range of bureaucratic kinds of challenges that face officers in doing their jobs. Whereas the operational stressors are things like experiencing trauma associated with things like child abuse and domestic assault and murdered parties and their family members and victims, et cetera. And so much of the research has suggested that these bureaucratic stressors are actually more detrimental to health and wellness of officers than are the more operational stressors and the trauma-based stuff, because officers have been trained to deal with those everyday things, and they deal with, I shouldn't say everyday things, but these traumatic types of things that are imposed by the job itself, having to use force, for example. That's another sort of operational stressor. But like I said, the evidence really suggests that these other things like paperwork, demands from the community or criticisms, lack of opportunities for advancement in the agency, et cetera, create a bulk of the stress. So that's something that we're looking at. But also at the National Police Foundation, we've worked on a number of other initiatives that address health and safety. We have a program that provides a $1,000 grant to individual officers in light of the pandemic for needs or issues that have been brought on by the pandemic with partners. We are doing a number of other things in this area. But again, to get back to your broad question, it's really a collection of mental well-being and physical well-being, and as they are integrated with each other. The other pillar of that, or the other side of that, is the safety issues. And so that deals with anything from the issue of ambushes and attacks on officers to different tactics in dealing with riotous mobs, as we've recently experienced, et cetera. And these are all issues that challenge the safety and the issues of how do we keep our officers safe in dealing with some of the pressing issues and the challenges that they face on the job.
Well, you know, the joke that I'm thinking of is those of us have been in policing that people would say, you really need a double layer in your back than in your front. In other words, you're more apt to be stabbed in the back by somebody who you work with or work for than by somebody that you're on a call for. So I understand that. And it'd be interesting to see how that grows. And more importantly, how it grows and what you find, but how it is implemented, how it is considered, and whether or not there's going to be a deafness of leadership when they see that and think that's not me, when reflection may cause them to say, I can be a better leader. I might be a better leader. I maybe have to pay more attention to the people side of the organization and such. So thank you for that.
On to that, that isn't something I'd actually heard, the double layer in the back of protection. But yesterday I participated in a webinar that was hosted by the American Psychological Association's Division of Psychologists in public Service. And we have a section within that that deals with things like psychological screening and wellness and whatnot. And yesterday our topic was on wellness checks, and it was from the perspective of psychological wellness check. There is a growing movement in some agencies to begin to do annual, in some cases mandatory, check-ins with a psychologist or other mental health provider to be what we call psychoeducational, meaning it's not clinical assessment. It's not like doing a fitness for duty to evaluate somebody, but rather to provide a resource for officers to just check in on their coping skills, the stress that they're under, and just have an opportunity to share that in a way that doesn't get documented back to the police department other than the fact that they attend it. And we're finding that this may be a new innovation that ought to be tested, but that allows for that check-in in a way that doesn't sound punitive. It's not like something that happens because of something an officer did, but just like a physical exam would do on an annual basis. It's that kind of a check-in. Only in this case, the psychologist is not evaluating the person unless they request referral to something like that. But they're rather being there as a resource to say, what kind of stressors have you experienced this year? Is there anything that you need in terms of coping? Is there information that we can share, strategies that we can share, and that type of thing? And so I think this idea of mental wellness is really in its infancy. And I mentioned in this webinar I participated in yesterday that there is some recent research that just came out by Thane and colleagues. It's T-O-E-H-E-N-E in 2019. And they evaluated through a national survey where they got 55 agencies of different sizes, but they asked about the kinds of wellness programs that were being implemented. And they ranged from anything from critical incident stress debriefings, which is, I guess, a form of wellness, to a whole range of other programs, but none of them mentioned this sort of annual psychological wellness check. And so, but there's all of these things that now are classified as wellness. And so we don't have a good way of defining what is wellness, but most of it relates to things like coping, stress, resilience, being psychologically and emotionally well, being physically well in a way that can support your resilience. And so it's a broad spectrum right now, but there's a lot of work that still needs to be done.
It is. And I'm glad I asked the question because it begins to extract what that wellness might mean. And I know that so many of my colleagues and even myself, there were things that I've been exposed to in my career that no one ever bothered to ask me how I feel. Anything from suicide that you responded to an untimely death, to a serious, I'm thinking of any number of things going through my mind, but even fatals, one of the fatals that I went to was 7 people and no one ever bothered to ask. And you're not sure how you cope with that. I think you hope you do, but I think that's going to be an uphill battle for clinicians because of the way police are raised to kind of keep it inside. If it is just about vent with me, talk to me, are you okay with it? Did you, you know, do you have a proper compartment for it? Are you okay? Does it impact how you will react? Even if somebody was attacked, does it impact how you react in another incident? And I think that's pretty important. So thank you for that. I think that's very, very important for sure. So a couple of questions would be either on your to-do list or in the National Police Foundation to-do list. What's coming? What is being thunk about before you move forward? How are you as a national organization working to provide resources, input, research for policing to make it better, especially in the current state where we are with policing, the issue of defunding and all of those kinds of
things? Well, again, just to emphasize an important point is that we're nonprofit, we're nonpartisan, we're independent, we don't have members. So we feel we have a unique and objective role to play that has a measured and balanced response to all kinds of challenges that allows objectivity in our science that can be in many ways without question. And this is not to criticize other organizations, but simply to say that if I'm a community member and I'm upset with the police, if I hear about research that's done by a police membership organization, I may say that I'm concerned that there's a bias there, that they are looking at this through the lens of how their membership feels about it. That may or may not be true, of course, but in generally, it's probably not true. But I think it gives us that unique voice to deal with a lot of these issues. So in terms of some of the things that you're talking about that we're facing, I can speak to a number of different initiatives, but I would say that our primary goals are in reduction of violence, particularly gun violence in our communities. This is not a recent issue, it's an ongoing issue, but one of the most disheartening to me, anyhow, having been with this organization for well over 25 years and also having worked for it 15 of those or more, in which our leadership, our president was African American and was a leader in civil rights issues and policing. He was the first executive director of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, or the first president, I should say. And that was Hubert Williams, who passed away sadly in early 2020. However, for years, he worked to examine the issues of race in policing. He and William Webster, Judge Webster, of course, the former head of the CIA and the FBI, the two of them worked with a team of about 100 lawyers and investigators in examining the aftermath of the riots in LA after the verdicts were returned on the Rodney King beating by members of the LAPD. And of course, that civil disturbance was massive and widespread and lasted for many days. It wasn't the first attempt, of course, that we made at really examining these issues of race, but it was one of the sort of watershed moments, I think, for policing to see and for communities to see video-based camera evidence of a beating of an individual who was already in custody and handcuffed. And so we continue to grapple, it's disheartening, with the issue of race in America. We've recently established a Council on Race and Policing Reforms. I am currently an appointee to a 12-member task force of the American Psychological Association on reducing force against African Americans, on police use of force against African Americans. But all of this really speaks to an ongoing challenge that we have in terms of disparate impacts on those of color, particularly African Americans, but also some other underrepresented groups. And so this challenge continues today, and this is one that we take very seriously and will continue to make every effort to address. A few moments ago, you talked about some moments in your career where nobody asked you anything and that there were these traumatic events. We, a few years ago, with funding from the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, started with many partner organizations something called Leo Near Miss, and it's at leonearmiss.org. Leo Near Miss is Law Enforcement Officer Near Misses, and it's an opportunity for officers at all levels in law enforcement agencies to report on incidents where something terrible could have happened but did. For example, I almost crashed my vehicle, and here's what I was able to do to not do that. Or this stakeout or this, let's say, raid could have resulted in the death of myself, my partner, or others in the residence that were innocent. But here's what we did that prevented it. So it gives an opportunity for officers to give voice and to share their voice with others who are trying to do their best to learn from past mistakes, right? So if I share my near miss with you, that as a peer, I can then say, oh, wow, I certainly don't want to end up in that situation. So it's a training tool. It started to generate a number of people entering this information because it's not identifying them in any personal way. It's not connecting it to a specific incident that could be under investigation. But these kind of peer-based tools are very important for examining the range of things that officers go through. We're also very focused on other issues associated with community and the role of police in community. This has been sort of where we cut our teeth in the early days in the 1970s. Much of our original work was formed the basis for what's more modern community policing, although the tenets, as you know, came out of Peel's principles in the 1800s, right? Yeah. But much of what has changed in the eras of policing reform and policing styles have gone from this sort of professional management model to one of community policing in which police and communities engage in collective problem solving. Of course, the evidence on community policing isn't exceptionally strong. And in fact, there's very little evidence to suggest any reductions in crime as a result of community policing. But there is evidence to suggest things, various aspects of community policing can reduce citizen fear of crime, and also, more importantly, can improve perceptions of legitimacy of the police, feelings that they're being treated fairly, etc. And part of that is just through treating people with equity and dignity and giving them voice. And so these are all issues that we address in our various projects. Part of what we do is action research, as you mentioned. Part of it is traditional and rigorous research. And then another part of it is the application of technology and technical assistance in agencies. So for example, one of the things that we've been doing, will continue to do, are after action reports of serious incidents that are very complex, starting with like the Christopher Dorner case in California that led to many people being killed, the chase into the mountains to find this guy, the San Bernardino shooting, the Pulse nightclub shooting, a number of these kind of things that involve multiple agencies in many cases and multiple complex issues that the police are dealing with. The purpose of these after action reports is a lot like what you hear about when they talk about these Sentinel event reviews, which are looking at sort of an all stakeholders approach, whereas the after action is to kind of investigate what we know about that incident, what are the lessons learned, et cetera. And so they kind of can go hand in hand. A Sentinel event review, which is much more non-blaming, not looking for a culprit in the process of how things went wrong, but looking at Sentinel events of the way the police handle situations in a way to examine sort of all of the aspect of the system breakdown. Many times it's a failure of training, but there could be other things.
It seems to me it's like the aftermath. There was a commission for the 9/11 and some of the last that were there. So I'm glad to hear that. We're winding down on time, but you've brought a whole bunch of things up and a couple of things that stick to me. The LEO near misses. And I think that so many times we get all of this stuff collected, there's a possible qualitative study in that to see what similarities and what can we learn. What are in other words, by coding it. And I won't get into the technical part, but that's a missed opportunity in my mind. But what are you most proud of? In other words, in history, with everything you have done, what's one thing you're most proud of that we would No, it was on you.
Organizationally or me?
As a researcher.
So me as a researcher personally, it was not the result of me, but a large team of scholars and other practitioners, was a study we did on the impacts of shift length on officer health, safety, and wellness. And the reason it's significant is not only that we found that longer shifts can be significantly taxing on officers, can lead to greater fatigue, also can be more costly for agents because of the amount of overtime payouts, et cetera. But more importantly, because it opened a new sort of era and emphasis on things that agencies can do to improve the lives of officers. Because in my philosophy, and this is probably a metaphor that's flying around way too frequently now, but I used to say it in the early days of this before I heard it said a lot, is it's a lot like getting on an airplane and the first instruction to you is, or one of the first instructions to you is, you know, if there's a loss in cabin pressure, the mass will drop down. First, secure your mass before trying to help anybody else. And I think this is something that was probably overlooked for many years in policing, that if we don't have safe, healthy, and psychologically well, meaning folks that have the resilience to be able to cope with a range of increasing challenges in this profession, then how can we expect them to provide high quality services to the community if they're reacting because they have stress, if they're reacting because there's things that the agency has done that has made it difficult for them to do their jobs instead of facilitating it? So I think that that's why I'm proud of it, because I think many of us in both the world of policing and research now look at ways to focus on the individual officers, their quality of life, and not seeing officers collectively as one group. You probably have seen this too, Steve, in your career, but people I know often will say, why do the police do X? Why do the police do Y? And my common response to that is, who do you mean when you say the police? Because every single person is an individual. And while there are certain occupational similarities, and some would argue some cultural similarities, some heterogeneity around cultural values and whatnot, those aren't as well supported today as they once were, like Niederhofer's belief in things like cynicism, et cetera, that build in the culture. We're seeing an emerging generation in newer officers that are very open to things that during your career, and I'm not trying to date you, Steve, but during your career, you would have laughed about people saying, well, I'm going to go engage in mindfulness practice. And that would be like, what? So I'm going to go take a yoga class. But yeah, many agencies, I have to give props to a colleague of mine, the chief out in Gilbert, Arizona, Chief Solberg, who on a recent visit there, were doing a study of militarization, knew of my interest in this area and took me aside and said, shh, I want to show you something. And he took me to three different rooms they had set aside in the police station. One was a mindfulness practice room where they had places where people could meditate or just sit quietly. Another was a lactating mother's room with a rocking chair for children, et cetera. And then the other was a sleeping room where they allow officers to, you know, with certain parameters, but to come in and take 20-minute or 30-minute rest breaks, right? These are things you never would have seen before. You would have been laughed out of town as a chief for recommending it or as a cop for doing it, right? So I think that there's a growing interest in these things amongst young cops. They've grown up with these kind of things. They've seen that their well-being, that their quality of life, that their family work balance is really important. And I think that's very encouraging. That is to say that the more that we can care about these people as individuals, as opposed to a collective or a homogenous group that all shares the same characteristic, the better off we'll be in being able to establish better community relations between individual officers and their communities.
You know, going back to what we said before, it is troubling to me, though we as a country and certainly as a world have suffered terrorism. We saw some domestic terrorism just last week. That I think 9/11 took a focus off of community policing, and I think it really caused police departments to reel back, because all of a sudden now we're not interested in community policing, while I think we should have been. This is my own two cents, because community policing could tell where the community might be changing and where police might look without profiling. Also a concern, but I think it's certainly time to get back to understanding that if police are to be responsible for the community, they have to know the community in which they police.
Right.
It's relationships. It's really about relationships.
Absolutely. And they can anticipate, as you mentioned, when you're doing things like being engaged with community, which is one of the tenets of community policing, you can anticipate other types of threats as opposed to being reactionary. Well, it's planes crashing into buildings that we're worried about. And then we miss, you know, tanks crashing through barriers into shopping malls and, you know, other kinds of threats that might be very different in nature. So you're absolutely right. I agree with you there.
So one more thing before we wind down. If you had a choice to sit with someone here in the now or before, who would you like to sit with? Who would you like to pick their brain?
Wow. You are one tough interviewer. I feel like I'm on the actor's studio. Let's see. I think I would have to say it's a toss-up between Mahatma Gandhi and the Dalai Lama. And the reason I say that is recently watched a broadcast on the Dalai Lama working with a range of officers from the London Metropolitan Police. And it was such an interesting interchange. And it took them out of that day-to-day grind that is their job into a broader perspective about humanity. And so I think people like them that have done tremendous things for the world can be of great benefit. And then I might also add that there's a former president that I think has really done some amazing things since leaving office, and that's Jimmy Carter. And this is not to take a political stance at all, but I think that somebody that can transition from one career to a career of service, one career of service, right, as a public servant, to a career in which service continues to be a central issue, I think is a lesson for all of us. And certainly for police that are contemplating a new career, they can take some real lessons from what Jimmy Carter has done post that. So, and I think that's another area that we need to explore is what can police do to continue their great contributions once they leave the field of policing and retire. There's still things that they can do to be of service, and many of them have, and we miss out on that. But it's hard to pick one, of course.
It is, but I appreciate that. And the Jimmy Carter piece that you just said, I remember being down here in South Carolina and seeing him at his age working on a house for Habitat for Humanity, and it just inspirational, to say the least. He doesn't have to do it. He was the damn president of the United States, and yet he continues to give. So kudos to you for that thought. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming aboard and being a part and for sharing, because I think, as I've said in this podcast, and the reason we started the podcast is because there's so much that we can learn from each other, and that I appreciate. I want to thank Dr. Karen Mendela from the National Police Foundation for joining us today. You've been listening to Steve Morielli and the Cop Doc podcast, and I'd like you to continue to listen so that you can learn and give us feedback.
Before you go, if you'd like to reach out, comment, provide feedback, or have a topic that could be considered to explore in the future, send me an email at copdoc.podcast@gmail.com. That's copdoc.podcast@gmail.com. Stay tuned for upcoming episodes where we'll be talking with a former member of the RCMP, a distinguished professor from Virginia Commonwealth University, the former commissioner of the Boston Police Department, and the academic director of the Baltimore Police Academy, to name just a few. I'm very happy now that the Cop Dog podcast is listed on Law Enforcement Today's podcast network. Among other police-related podcasts I'd recommend, when you have time, I suggest you take time to listen to Law Enforcement Today Radio with Jay Wiley. You might also listen to Pat Fitzgibbons on his podcast, The CJ Evolution, or Policing Matters from Police One, with Jim Dudley. You can find links to these recommended police-related podcasts on our website at www.copdocpodcast.com. Intermittently, you'll hear from me in micro-podcasts called Reflections and Ruminations on Leadership. These short pieces will raise leadership and organizational issues and discuss problems and practices, as well as the elements of leadership for you to consider. I look forward to continuing to talk with colleagues in the field of policing, criminal justice think tanks, community, academics, and researchers. And for those of you still in the trenches, I wish you my best and implore you to stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you for what you do to keep our community safe. This is Steve Morielli in Boston. Thanks so much for listening to the Cop Doc Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Cop Doc Podcast with Dr. Steve Morielli. Steve is a retired law enforcement practitioner and manager turned academic and scholar from Worcester State University. Please tune into the Cop Doc Podcast for regular episodes of interviews with thought leaders in policing.